Hey everyone, this is Ken Klippenstein, reporter for The Intercept, and you're listening to Goddamn GameCube.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Goddamn GameCube. Greg and Riley are your hosts today. Today we are discussing one of the most critically acclaimed games of the early 2000s, Eternal Darkness. This game is frequently cited as not only the best GameCube game, but one of the most influential games in gaming history. And before we start, I want to introduce our guest panelists today. Ken Klippenstein is here with us. He is an investigative journalist primarily focused on matters of national security. He currently reports for The Intercept, though he previously operated as a correspondent for The Nation, and his work has appeared in other publications such as The Daily Beast and Salon. Ken, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing all right. Good to be with you guys.
How's now, your sanity meter today?
You know, it's funny. That term entered into my lexicon. I used that during, I just casually, like during 2020 with the lockdown and everything, I remember commenting to my wife that my sanity meter feels pretty loaded and she doesn't know about the game. So I'm thinking maybe that's I should give her a primer.
Yeah, right. That's a great bit. So before we get into the game, this anecdote is funny to me. Ken, I don't know if it's funny to you. The story of kind of how we got connected for you to come on the show is humorous to me. So I remember, I think you had tweeted out something about Eternal Darkness, how I think you said it was like one of the best examples of like Lovecraftian horror or something like that.
I said the best adaptation of Lovecraft. It's been a frustration of mine that there are so few, in my opinion. There were just, you know, I grew up playing this game and then reading Lovecraft and realizing that they, you know, drew from the same mythos and wishing that there was a better adaptation of it. And I haven't found a better one than this.
Very interesting. So what I find funny is I think we kind of went back and forth on Twitter, and then I was talking to Riley and our other crew members, and I said, I'm just going to call him. Like, maybe he'd want to come on the show and do it. And I think Riley had like made a joke. He said, you know, Ken's probably waiting for like, you know, Trump indictment news and other stuff. And it's just me on his voicemail being like, dude, you want to come talk about Eternal Darkness? Like on his office line.
Oh, are you kidding? I'll talk about GameCube games that should have gotten more credit anytime with anybody.
Dude, let's go.
It's so funny because I was like right in the middle. I think Greg and I were both in the middle of playing it for the first time. And then I see someone talking about Eternal Darkness on my timeline. I'm like, wait, what's going on here? But I'm glad you're a fan.
Yeah, I had a lot going for it. I mean, again, I study literature in college. And so I'm like pretty familiar with the time in which Lovecraft was writing. And it's always been a frustration of mine that he'd never really entered the canon because he's written off as sort of, oh, this is horror. We'll take this stuff seriously. And in much the same fashion, because of that, I don't think that there's been a very serious effort to adapt it into film, you know, other parts of the culture. And so yep. I do actually feel pretty strongly about this game.
Right on. So before I kick it to Riley to get into the nitty gritty of the game, can you tell us about your history with Eternal Darkness? You have a little bit, like, how did you find out about it? Like, when did you play it for the first time? That kind of thing.
Yeah, when I was growing up, my group of friends, I remember there were different like factions. There were like the PlayStation kids and there were the Nintendo kids. And I was a Nintendo kid, and a frustration of like ours was kind of like, you know, like I really liked Nintendo, but it was kind of like, man, I wish I'd have a little bit more like, I mean, we were still just teenagers then, but we were like, I wish there was more like grown-up content or whatever. And obviously that's how they try to brand this game, but playing it, boy, did they hit the mark. I was so spooked by it as a little kid. And a lot of it was inchoate because the ideas that he's communicating, they were communicating borrowed from Lovecraft pretty heavily. You know, it's existential horror. It's not jump scares. It's like,
yeah,
an atmosphere. I mean, if you read Lovecraft, it's so setting driven.
Yeah.
Not only are there no jump scares, if you look at it, there's very little dialogue. Dialogue must be like a fraction of a percent of what he's doing compared to so much fiction today where it's extremely plot driven and dialogue driven and things. This was just like pulls the rug out from under you because it's so different than what you expect. So it really left an impression with me, and I didn't realize exactly what it was. You know, this idea of like powerful forces guiding things behind the scenes, like as a kid, you're kind of like seeing these ideas in the game. But until I read Lovecraft later, I didn't have that aha moment of, oh, this is what they were getting at. And it just, I don't know, it really stuck with me in an indelible way.
Got it. So Riley, before you take it away, just that pinged kind of a question in my brain. Did either of you play the director's previous game, Legacy of Kain, or no?
I did not.
I didn't.
Okay. So Riley, let's go right into the game. So you take it away. Let's do it.
Sure. So for any listeners who may not be aware, Eternal Darkness, Sanity's Requiem, I would describe it as an action-adventure game which has some puzzle and survival horror elements developed by a studio called Silicon Knights, which I believe is no longer in existence. And it was published by Nintendo in 2002 for the GameCube. This was, I believe, their first M-rated publication, which is, you know, kind of what you were saying, just getting a little bit more grit into the catalog there. Notably, the game was originally developed for the N64 and was approaching release readiness in 2000. But as Nintendo had begun to pivot to the GameCube, many aspects needed to be fully redone or retooled, including like the rendering engine, the art assets, the sound, and the dev tools. So there's quite a lot of that. It seems like a huge pain in the ass. But so the overarching story here kicks off with a young woman named Alex Roivas returning to her family's mansion in Rhode Island after her grandfather, Edward, is found murdered there. When the detectives come up empty-handed, Alex decides to investigate the death herself. Searching the mansion for clues, she uncovers a secret room in the basement and a book bound in human skin called The Tome of Eternal Darkness. So the vibe I was getting here is that The Tome of Eternal Darkness is essentially like when you check into a hotel and you sign the guest book, and it's that, but it's over the course of 2,000 years. And it's essentially, so there's multiple different protagonists, 12 different people from various backgrounds all over the world, and they kind of have to work together over time to vanquish this dark god that threatens to, you know, destroy humanity or whatever. So we've covered actually a couple other games that dealt with Lovecraftian horror, but this one, as Ken was saying, maybe the purest embodiment of it. I want to actually start with Greg here. Like, how do you feel about Lovecraftian fiction, and what are some of your other favorite works of this subgenre, if so?
Now, I'm going to say something that's either going to be very funny, you guys are going to roll your eyes. Like, okay. I've actually never read Lovecraft, and this might have been my first experience with it, unless there's been a game I've played where it is that, and I wasn't aware.
I would call Bloodborne Lovecraft.
Oh, okay.
That's
you know, I get it. Yeah.
That kind of thing. Ken, did you ever mess around with Bloodborne?
No, I didn't, and maybe I should reserve my judgment that this is the best adaptation because I've heard good things about it.
It's pretty solid, I think, but there's some of the same ideas going on there. But do you have do you have like a favorite Lovecraft book, or do you have anything else?
I would
say
At the Mountains of Madness.
Yeah.
He's really just good. Here's the thing. It's seen as this kind of comic book science fiction stuff by the kind of stuffy part of the literati. But the reality is, I think he was synthesizing this intellectual agoraphobia that must have taken place at the turn of the century.
Oh, yeah.
As a consequence of realizing how small we are in the universe, science telling us not just literally how small we are, but also, you know, the departure from Newtonian physics, starting to realize that things are way less intuitive than you know, our sciences thought. He just, you know, communicated that so beautifully in a way that I don't think any other writer did at that point in time. So at one point in At the Mountains of Madness, the book basically is about these archaeologists going up to Alaska or the Arctic rather to excavate. And so they're describing going just miles down under the rock and seeing just, you know, just millennia and millennia, or just, you know, eons of species that we can't even conceptualize so long. And can you imagine having discovered that at that time and how much of a, frankly, mind fuck that must have been? Like,
yeah,
for,
yeah,
you know, exactly. What I mean? Like, and I remember as a kid having that exact same sense of agoraphobia and realizing, oh my god, everything, you know, being the sort of dominant species, you really, it's hard to imagine.
You kind of take it for granted at first.
Yeah. Exactly. And just like how small you are. And then the implications of that being that, well, someday we're going to be those fossils. And I don't see any other genre that could communicate that than horror.
No,
like,
absolutely.
Horror's never taken very seriously. But I think it's really hard to do. It's kind of like comedy in that if your timing and atmosphere, everything isn't just right, it doesn't work. I've always thought it was one of the most difficult, you know, types of writing to pull off.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say, too, you were talking about, I was actually trying to think before the show, I was like, what kind of Lovecraftian movies am I aware of? And there's really not that many. And I think I think Guillermo del Toro at one point wanted to adapt at the Mountains of Madness, but he has like so many projects that didn't come to fruition, unfortunately. But
there was an amazing interview of him. He says, they said, why couldn't you do it? He said, well, the problem is we can't, you need a love story to get anybody to pay to sell it enough to make it offset its costs.
Sure.
And that would just be so antithetical to everything that Lovecraft
yeah, means, yeah, you know? It wouldn't work at all. But I wanted to invoke a quote here from the director of this game. I believe his name is pronounced Dennis Dyack. Video games were under fire for messing with people's heads at the time. You know, a lot of the Tipper Gore stuff was going on and whatnot, and being accused of being murder simulators and stuff. So we thought, wouldn't it be a good idea to make something that really does mess with people's heads? And I think it definitely does in a lot of ways. So I'd like to kind of get into the gameplay and just what you're going to be doing kind of as you play this game. Very notably, this game features three different paths based on which artifact is chosen at the beginning of the game. There's like a red, green, and blue one. And this governs which god and its minions you will be kind of facing over the course of the story. And there's also this kind of Pokemon like rock, paper, scissors relationship between the three of them, where, you know, red beats green, green beats blue, and blue beats red. So what this means is basically that, like, when you're fighting monsters that are aligned with the red god, if you enchant your weapon, let's say, with the blue magic, you do extra damage against them or whatever. So do you recall at the time which one you chose, or did you do it multiple times, or like
definitely try the different paths? I don't remember which one I first chose.
Greg, which one did you do?
Okay, so if I fought red, does that mean I chose blue? I believe that's what that means.
Is it? Okay.
I believe so.
I think so. I chose green and I was fighting green. So I think that might be the way it works. But
okay.
Either way, you get the gist. I think so. There's a common conception that green is like the easiest path and red is the hardest. So considering I only played through it once, I can't really say how true that is. But I think it could have been made a little clearer when choosing if that was the case, because I wasn't really, it was just kind of like, just pick it up. I mean, we could just grab one of them. But I don't know. I didn't struggle too much when I played it.
I mean, what I didn't realize was if you pick red, that means like enemies do more damage to you. If you pick green, enemies do more insanity damage to you.
Yes.
And then blue is there's some sort of magic minus.
Magic or damage. Yeah.
I didn't realize. I guess I played it on hard mode, but I didn't. It's not made very clear. It's kind of like the Resident Evil rock climbing thing. I guess you picked hard. Like,
do you enjoy rock climbing or not? Yeah. So it's on that subject, the skeleton of the gameplay, I would say, is fairly similar to something like Resident Evil, where, you know, you're walking around, you have an inventory, albeit unlimited in this case, that, you know, you have your weapons, your restorative items, and, you know, puzzle solving objects. And you, on that subject, you have three resources you kind of have to manage, which is your vitality, your health, your magic, and your sanity, which was quite unique to this game. So these can be replenished by finite items depending on the character. The recover spell once you learn it, or a visit to the trapper area dimension. Can we talk about that a little bit? It's so weird.
The trapper dimension stuff is really weird.
Yeah.
Like, at first, when I first started playing it, I thought the trapper thing was supposed to be like a punishment, because it sends you to this other plane. But I've read online that players use the trapper thing as like a healing station. Like, they purposely get caught, and because when you go into that like other plane, there are these like warp pads that recover your stats. So players use it as like a safe haven. I don't really get it. Like, Ken, do you have a take on this trapper thing when you get caught by the little things and you get sent somewhere? It's really weird, but that's all I've got.
Yeah, it was just weird. It's supposed to be like other plane of existence or something, I think, that you have to kind of like fight through to get sent back, if I remember right. Is that what it was?
Yeah,
that's right.
I think it's kind of testament to this game at times feels a little bit like a tabletop game, or like kind of there's some elements of strategy there where it could be a punishment because, yeah, you're losing like where you were at the time, and there's more monsters in this dimension and stuff. But you can, if you plan it out, like if you need to restore your magic or whatever, you can just go there and use it. That it's like this weird like Mario Party board that you show up in. And it's one thing that I did like about it is that a couple times you have to send stuff there and it stays there for the rest of the game, like a body and like an obelisk or something. And it's like, I like that consistency. But Yeah, that's that weird mechanic there. I'd like to get into the magic system a little bit. Perhaps the most fleshed out aspect of the game. There's a handful of spells. They require at least three words to incant, and you have to remain perfectly still when casting them. One of the words is always the god you're invoking. One is the action you're taking, like project, absorb, summon, protect, or dispel. And one is the object you're practicing it on, like the item, area, creature, or self. Later on, you can unlock 5 and 7 word spells, which to the best of my understanding are always just more powerful versions of the three words. And you can also discover a purple rune later on, which represents, I think, the most powerful god that's like above all the three others. So over the course of the story and millennia, each character will pick up new words and spell recipes that are recorded within the Tome of Eternal Darkness. A couple weird things about this I noticed. For one, like each chapter jumps around in time quite a bit. Like it doesn't say like, you know, okay, we're starting 26 BC and then like chronologically going each one. It does jump around a bit, and it doesn't really make sense who has access to what spells at what time if they are writing it down in the book. And another thing was Greg brought it to my attention how funny it is that most of the characters seem very nonplussed that they can do magic now. It's just like, it's not even addressed at all. I'm like, I'd have a few things to say about it, but yeah, I don't know. But what do you guys think about the magic system? Do you have any favorite or least favorite moments with it? Or how do you feel? Greg, you want to start?
Sure. So I think the cool part about the magic system, the more that I played it, I was realizing that when your character is saying the spell, they have to say all of the words in the spell in order. And it took me a couple of hours to realize what was happening, you know, because you have to stay completely still and your character is actually saying the incantation out loud. Well, then it's not their voice, but I thought that was very neat. I mean, it's also very annoying that like you get interrupted by everything, including taking a step, anything touching you also stops it.
Yeah.
Also, like if I'm remembering correctly, you have to discover the spells, but you can also create them without discovering them. And it's not super clear.
That's right.
And, you know, there you can also make the different spells different colors, but I feel like it got beyond me a little bit. I started sort of like, just kind of trial and erroring some of the stuff because I didn't understand what was going on.
Sure.
Like, Ken, do you have a take on the magic system?
I remember it being frustrating, like how you were saying is interrupted. And I don't know if this is intentional or not, but much like I was a weird kid. I must have been 12 or 13 when I was playing this game, I think. And I remember one of my favorite things as a kid to do was go and read the reviews of them for some reason. And then I remember they were dinging it on how clunky the like just aiming, like the character like aiming the gun or whatever. And,
sure.
And much like that, I actually thought that bolstered it because it felt kind of like a stress dream where it was like, you're kind of like, oh God, nothing's going right. And you can't, it just won't work. It won't listen to you. And, and I don't know, maybe I'm reading too far into it, but in a way I felt like that enhanced the nightmarish quality that they were going for.
You know what? One of our friends, Nick, who has come on the show, has talked about this a little bit where it may fall into this category where the spell casting being clunky and the shooting being clunky makes a lot of sense in the universe. Like if you're just a normal person having to cast a spell out of a book, of course it's going to take you forever, but it doesn't translate to the gameplay being great, but it fits the story better.
Right.
Like none of you, like, I mean, this sounds ridiculous, but like you're playing as realistic characters. No one's a wizard. You know what I mean? Right. Like, it's like, it wouldn't make sense, but it makes sense.
Some of them are like
holding
a gun for the first time in their lives too. So
yeah, exactly.
For my part, I do appreciate what you mentioned a little earlier, Greg, about how you are able to discover new spells before you officially find their instructions. By just like experimenting with the different words, because that feels very kind of Lovecraftian as well. Like, oh, I'm just like, I'm concocting something. I don't even know what the effects are going to be. And for better or worse, it's going to happen. But the best uses for me, there's a couple notable moments where you learn like the enchant item spell in the past. And in the future, you use it to repair like a broken key, which opens up a room in the mansion. I was like, when that happened, I was like, man, this is some good ass game design here. Mm-hmm. And the bind spell as well, where you can learn how to like pit enemies against each other. I always love that. I did feel like sometimes when you have to use the it's like reveal invisible or whatever, because it always feels like kind of like what you were saying, where it feels like the last option I tried when I was stuck, like, I don't know, fuck it, I'll just cast reveal invisible and see if it does anything.
Kind of trial and erroring some of these puzzles, like, fuck it, I guess I'll cast blue invisible, I don't know, like,
yeah, exactly. Just give it a shot. And there's a couple where you need to summon like the trapper, the little bug creature, and use it to warp stuff out of the way. And I didn't realize at first that you have to aim when you're doing that. And I was like, what am I doing wrong? But I don't know. It's overall a very interesting set of mechanics. Getting into like the sights and sounds a little bit. Greg, you want to start here? How do you feel about this game's music and art direction?
So I think when it comes to the aesthetic stuff, this correct me if I'm wrong, is this 2002?
It is.
Right, when this came out. So what I think is this game came out like between the Resident Evil 1 remake and Wind Waker, which are arguably the two best looking GameCube games that there are.
Yeah.
So I think this game kind of hits the middle point. I don't think it's not the best looking like GameCube game. Like, I think that's Resident Evil 1. Some people would say Wind Waker, but I think for the time period that this came out, the guns are very impactful. Like, it's very loud and very punchy. Yeah. And I think we'll get into the sanity meter effects, but the way they muck with your perception of audio at times is very interesting. You know, the screen, the game muting itself and cutting off all the high end and making it feel like you can't hear anything is very interesting.
Awesome.
But you know, but visually, like, character models, poly count, it's kind of middle of the road. Like, there are better looking GameCube games, if you ask me, that came out at that time,
but also worse ones, I would say.
Oh, for sure.
Ken, how do you feel?
Yeah, I agree. Technically, it wasn't the best executed, like what we were saying about the mechanics and everything, but it was such an ambitious game. Like, you look at the mechanics, you could find a lot of these mechanics in different games, but never all in the same one. So it's like, look at Resident Evil, for instance. That's just a straight shooter. You could focus all your attention on the dynamics of a shooter. That's a lot or not shooter exactly, but you know what I mean. But then they're incorporating like the rock, paper, scissors, magic stuff, and then all this weird. It's just like a lot for such an early, it just seemed very, what's the word, ahead of its time.
Yeah,
I absolutely.
Ken, you actually brought something up that I was going to talk about next, so I'll touch on it now. Like, I had in my notes here that the gameplay of this is kind of like Resident Evil meets Myst meets Alone in the Dark, but it has an RPG magic system, which is a lot of weird things to put together, right?
And somehow, well, I mean, it kind of works. Like,
it's weird is a great word for it, which is, I love that, because that's what they called, that's what that era of fiction is called. That's what it's grouped into, weird fiction.
Weird fiction.
Coming from, I think, Shakespeare, the Weird Sisters. And it's just like this kind of, it's like a little bit askance. You know what I mean? There's something weird about it, but it's difficult to put your finger on. And I can't think of a better way to.
It has that like X factor kind of, like, it's like something about it. Yeah. Greg, did you have more to say there?
Yeah, I think you guys are correct here where it's clearly a Resident Evil 1 inventory system. You're solving puzzles, you're putting objects down. But when I think about it, I'm like, what game is this game closest to? Nothing. But I don't know if you guys have any familiarity with like Parasite Eve, if you guys had ever played it. That is a Resident Evil clone, but it's an RPG where you level up and have stats, and it's really weird. That's the only thing where I could think of. It's a Resident Evil inventory system with an RPG magic system, which I've never seen before or after. So even though it's not the best at any of those things, it's so bizarre where it's very, I said in the intro, it's a very like historically significant game for many reasons. And it's probably the coming together of all those things in a way.
Can you imagine what the business people were saying? Like, you pick lane, man, you gotta sell this thing.
I'm going to guess there was no pitch for this game. This game was, hey guys, Legacy of Kain sold really well. I'm the guy. Nintendo wants an M-rated game. I'm the guy. Let's do it. I'm going to do whatever I want. That's what it looks like. I mean, you could never get this game greenlit, right? Like, hey guys, it's a horror game, but there are no jump scares and there's a magic system and none of our fans have read Lovecraft, but we're doing it. Like, okay, man.
It is crazy that it even happened. I would say that I think aesthetically, even if fidelity wise, it hasn't held up super well, I do think the art direction is pretty strong. I think the sound and music are effective at creating the atmosphere. At least there's that very intense track that's playing anytime you're in the mansion. It's like feels very, you know, just ominous and oppressive. I did want to ask too, maybe start with Greg again here. What did you think of the voice acting for its time? Did you think it was satisfactory? Anything jump out at you?
So I think voice acting in 2002 is a tricky subject because it's mostly poor, not in this game, but it's mostly poor industry-wide. It's pretty poor. I thought this game, again, like if I have to compare it to what came out around it, which is Resident Evil 1 Remake and Prince of Persia Sands of Time, this game is better than Resident Evil 1 and at times better than Sands of Time as well. I also think for the kind of content they were trying to make, I think they tried. And let me say this. I think I have a hard time getting into like otherworldly plots or like things that aren't grounded in realism. So I think the better voice acting moments are probably like Alex, modern day. I think those are a little bit better. When you get into like when you're in like ancient Persia and stuff, I think it's a little bit wonkier. But I think it's better than what you would expect from a 2002 game. But that's And Ken, do you have any more on that? That's what I would say.
Something that was just breathtaking to me when I played it was how seamlessly they transitioned from what was the Roman centurion general's name? I can't remember his name.
Oh, Pius.
Yeah, Pius speaking Augustus in Latin, and then it slowly, if I remember right, it slowly transitions into English. Mm-hmm. And I, again, as a kid, being impressed by thinking like that makes you think about the passage of time, where we inhabit, you know, like a dead language. We're basically Rome now. How long will we be the dominant language? Blah blah blah. But then as I got older, you read. I think in Ulysses, the James Joyce novel, he has the exact same device. And so in retrospect, as a kid, I'm basically consuming like art and not realizing that that's what it is. And in retrospect, seeing how much was borrowed from literature, from, you know what I mean? Like, it's really thoughtful. And so that's one thing that stuck with me. And then as for the voice acting, I can't really remember, but what I appreciated about it, again, none of the mechanics were particularly well done individually, but what I appreciate about it, you mentioned before that I'm a national security reporter.
Yeah.
You know, the Pentagon spends a lot of time on what's called grand strategy, making sure that our strategy in Asia and our strategy in South America, our strategy in the Middle East, that it all coheres. So I would say that if you break down the individual points, none of it is particularly impressive on technical grounds, but it all felt so, the gestalt was very, it seemed like it was all coherent, whereas games now, it feels like you have different teams working on different things and it doesn't feel like they're all on the same page, if that makes sense. Or at least the games that I've tried playing.
Do you think better than the sum of its parts is not a bad
exactly
word? Yeah. Actually, now that you brought that up, that's a good point too, where it starts in Latin and the subtitles are in Latin, then it goes to English. I forgot about that, so that's a good point. Something I wanted to bring up, Riley, before we move on too quick, something that actually really impressed me was how all the weapons and items are time period and area appropriate, which correct, I thought was really cool. I just don't want to go too quick over that because that jumped out to me was where, okay, like if when you're like in early 1900s with like a World War I reporter, you have a Wembley revolver, which is very, you know, time period specific. Like Augustus has a Gladius and it's really neat. And I loved how do I put this? The game tried to do a bunch of different gameplay, but the gameplay was identical the whole time. And because it made it period. Like example, what's the, I think it's the second character you play as, the woman, Ellie? Is it Ellie?
Yeah.
And she has you get like a blow dart gun or something like that, which they did a really good job with that kind of stuff, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also, there is a detailed description of each of them when you go through them. And it's like, it's very, you can tell they did their homework, which is not the case for all games.
There's so much fidelity to the spirit of what Lovecraft was, because I think what they're driving home with this grand passage of time is reminding you how small of a place that we inhabit, even within humanity. Forget about like, you know, organisms on Earth. Right. Even in humanity. And it just this sweeping thing from you know, antiquity to modernity. It's just such an ambitious game, you know?
For sure.
That's insane.
Now, Riley, before you continue, last point I wanted to bring up, we're going to get into a lot. What I really liked is how each character actually has individual stats, and there are some hidden stats. Did you look into this at all? Because I went all in into this kind of stuff.
I noticed how some characters were faster than others, or, you know, obvious. The most obvious stuff is that their meters are clearly different. For like health and magic and sanity and stuff like
what,
that.
What I thought was really cool was like the character's running speed is a hidden stat. You can't look at a number. And also the amount of stamina you have when it comes to swinging a weapon or go or like committing to an action is also hidden. So some right. of the more physically capable characters can swing a weapon over and over while the other characters can't, which I right. thought was very thoughtful. Yeah, continue with the next subject.
No, I just wanted to put a button on that. And for as far as the voice acting and performances go, I think it was pretty successful. I think you said, especially regarding the content that they had to perform for its time, considering a lot of, you know, voice acting in video games was very, for better or worse, gamey, you know, unless besides like Metal Gear Solid or something like that. There's some a little bit more advanced concepts in this one. And I appreciated that, you know, for its time, they did a decent job with respect to the language as well. I think that's a great because, oh, my God, I had such a good time watching recently that Chernobyl show. And that my one gripe was that it was all in English. And I was like, this Eternal Darkness did it better where you have them start out in the native language and then it, you know, it's like it's just presumed that this is what everyone is speaking their own language over the course of the game, and like you get the gist, right? So I thought that was cool. But moving on a little bit, perhaps one of the most famous aspects of this game is the role of the aforementioned sanity meter. So as it lowers, certain hallucinatory events will begin to occur. These manifest in a variety of ways, both auditory and visual. The camera in particular will develop a little bit of a cant, and it'll kind of shake and try to right itself as if it's alive. And you'll begin to hear, you know, weird sounds like screaming and crying. So maybe starting with Ken, can we talk about some of our favorite sanity meter incidents? Do you remember any in particular?
One of them that I remember was the protagonist Alex committing suicide with a shotgun, and then you're sitting there like, wait, hold on, no, I'm not doing that. And it's like,
right,
maybe it was because I was a little kid, but it was like, it was genuinely kind of like disorienting.
Yes.
Yeah, because sometimes you thought maybe you did something wrong and you were wondering what was causing it, you know.
Right.
I there's a similar moment too. I think you're playing as Kareem. I don't remember, but and if you have low health and you cast a healing spell, your character will just get sawed in half and then he'll come back to life. I was like, what? Like, I at first I was mad. I was like, dude, come on. Like, because my sanity's low, is it a game over? It's not.
It's not.
There's a really...
That would have killed it.
Dude, there's a really mean one where it tells you when you go to save your game that it's going to delete all your save data. You remember this?
That's the cruelest one. That's like, so, oh my God.
And do you guys remember how some of the paintings in the mansion will change? Where yeah. like, yeah, some like of the, they look like very sinister. Normal... Yeah, they'll look more like devilish and sinister the lower your sanity is, which is very neat.
Yeah, I had a couple, if you guys don't mind,
sure.
That were my favorites. I think my all-time favorite is, this is just like my Looney Tunes brain. I find stuff like this really funny, is where Alex was walking around the mansion with a low sanity meter, and every time you walk through a door... She got caught in a loop and she got smaller and smaller every time. I'm like, wait, when is this going to end? And she's like very, very small at the end. And it's, I love that. Similar to what you were talking about, there is one where if you reload a gun, it accidentally goes off in the middle of reloading it and like shoots you in the stomach and you die. I was like, oh my God,
yep.
That was crazy. There's one where your character will gradually start sinking into the floor. Like it's yep. quicksand and like your just head is poking out. Walking into some rooms and they're upside down. I like that a lot.
Yep.
It's like really, really disorienting.
And the, do you remember like the 90s style mute level? Like you're turning down the TV with your remote.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's a good one too.
I fell for awesome. That one. And I also, I can't, it's embarrassing how many I fell for, because I should have caught on at a certain point. But there was like the flies, a fly was like walking across the screen. And I
yeah.
remember going up to the screen being like, goddamn fly, get the thing out of there. And then realizing it was like in the game.
Yeah. Yep. that's a good one too.
Yeah, there's a couple like kind of Hideo Kojima like Metal Gear stuff going on. I think yep. Another favorite was I get to a loading screen and it just says, "Thank you for completing the game. Please look forward to the sequel, Sanity's Redemption." There's
yeah.
like a fake logo and everything for it. Just unbelievable. So this, in general, speaking, the sanity meter system was actually patented by Nintendo in 2005, and during development was subject to a lot of scrutiny on their part, presumably because they were concerned people would genuinely believe like their hardware was faulty, or their, and like, you know, in the process of trying to troubleshoot it, inadvertently damage their actual hardware. So
yep.
I think it's like the save game corruption thing is like, that's how far you can take it. But
yep.
Other than that, so if it's all right with you guys, I would like to get into the story super quick. Again, this is going to vary based on like which path you took and everything, but I'm going to try to keep it pretty lean. I'm just going to go through each chapter and just kind of very briefly summarize what each one is about. And we can kind of give a thumbs up or thumbs down to each one if you feel compelled. So let's get into it. So pretty straightforward. After that intro I mentioned earlier with Alex finding the Tome of Eternal Darkness, the first character is the Roman centurion Pius, who is tasked by the emperor with finding an artifact. Ultimately, this binds him as a servant to one of the gods that we mentioned earlier, and he appears in various cutscenes therefore as like a primary antagonist. Thumbs up or thumbs down on Pius? What do we think?
I think it's thumbs so. Up? I think, okay, let me say this. I thought the scenario was fine, but yeah. I like when games are smarter than me, because right. This game did this and Heavy Rain did this too. I can't believe I'm saying Heavy Rain was smarter than me, but you know that thing where like you're playing as a character, but you're actually playing as the villain, but you don't know
yeah.
yet. Yeah. So it did do that. And also, I mean, I didn't understand what picking the colored artifact did, but a pat on the back is the game. I didn't understand what the game was asking me to do, but good for them. Yeah. So, I mean, I thought it was fine. Ken, thumbs up or down?
Oh, definitely thumbs up.
Yeah. I mean, also, like you had mentioned the Latin to English, that was very smart.
Him being lured away. And I think he was like a prominent general or something. He was lured away from his retinue of other soldiers. Something about that is so Lovecraftian. It's like the idea that no matter your station in life, there are things more powerful than you that can hurdle you into chaos.
And to time and again, really, really seeing this unfold. And I wasn't really even this chapter, I think, is great because I wasn't really sure how to feel about it at first, because all you really can do is swing your sword. And then at a certain point that, you know, the coin drops and you can do magic and stuff. I'm like, oh, this game is like actually pretty deep. So I would give that a thumbs up as well. I believe the next one is Elia, who is in 1150 Cambodia. Who is a court dancer who consumes one of the artifacts, the Heart of Mantarok, and becomes undead. Thumbs up or thumbs down for her?
I have no opinion on this one. I thought it was fine. And I feel like I was at the point in the game where I'm like, there's a giant eyeball monster. I don't understand what's happening. Like, there's a blowgun. It's fine. I don't know. I think I'm, you know what? Fine, even though this is an audio only podcast, so I will say I guess thumbs down, because it didn't really bother me, because she also doesn't really return to the story either. Like, it's very brief.
She does once, but
yeah, it's like, yeah. Once next.
Okay. Anthony in 814 France, a messenger who reads a cursed scroll intended for his liege Charlemagne and gradually turns into a zombie because of it.
So I actually have a lot of opinions on this one. This may have been my favorite one, because visually this is where the game hit a lot of like Greg checkboxes sure. that I'm looking for. So like as Anthony, like, you know, you like you read a scroll and then you start to see your face get grayed and you start to limp, like your skin is like falling off and your limbs stop functioning. What I think is really cool is like, your character will start limping, your movement speed is lower, and also if you let Anthony just stand around, he will put a dagger through his hand and not feel any pain, and he'll be grossed out about what's happening to him.
Oh man,
if you leave the controller alone, which I think is really neat. There's also a really neat part about this. You can't die in this scenario. I don't know if you guys really know this. No. Because they did this very clever thing where, because Anthony, he doesn't know it, but he's becoming undead. So if you run out of HP, he will just stand back up at full HP, which I thought was very interesting.
That's awesome.
Thumbs up for me. Ken, do you have anything on Anthony?
Oh, strong thumbs up, because again, another thing I'd learn in literature later, just how grotesque It was. And in the context of literature, grotesque doesn't mean gross, or doesn't mean gross exactly. It means incongruous. There are two things that don't go together, and in the incongruousness, it shocks you. And that's what the this like undead zombie who was also supposed to be this man of God or whatever, as a kid, that really struck me and stuck with me. There, I mean, there are a few scenes that are just seared in my mind. One is when the camera pans out and it's pious, and it's just the skeleton face, the licking face, you know?
Right,
and then
the other
one was the priest. I would say those are the two most memorable parts that just, I mean, maybe it's old hat. Maybe it was just the first time I'd seen it as a kid, but just like wearing the robes and then underneath it, it's like this undead thing of like evil, you know? It's like very shocking to me.
Yeah, it's awesome. I give it a thumbs up as well. Two things about it. Number one, in addition to like the movement stuff you were talking about, I think his, like you gradually can swing your sword a lot slower. Like it's like he can't lift it as much as he can at the beginning, which I thought was a nice detail. And as well, kind of just this, how it starts, I think really plays into the thesis statement of Lovecraftian horror, where all this happens because this guy read a scroll that was meant for somebody else. Like he was pursuing information that he wasn't really, you know, meant for.
Forbidden knowledge. Yeah,
exactly. Yep. Yeah. So I thought that it worked really well. So next we have Karim in 565 Persia. So he is a Persian swordsman who attempts to retrieve one of the artifacts from the Forbidden City that Pius was visiting earlier to impress his love. Greg, what do we think about Kareem?
I mean, I'm trying to make like a Prince of Persia joke, but I can't really find one.
it's not really coming to you.
No, it's not coming. It's fine. You know what? We're very positive on the game, but like if I will levy like one critique at the game, at this point when I started playing as Kareem, I started to notice the gameplay becomes, Riley, I don't think you agree with this, it starts to become kind of the same loop, right? Where like you play as a character, you solve a puzzle by putting an item somewhere, and it's Resident Evil gameplay. And I think with Kareem, nothing really stood out to me. Also, like, I don't know if this was on purpose, but at that point, the story, I didn't understand what was happening, but it makes more sense later. Like why Kareem like chooses to stay behind and defend something. Like it took me a long time to understand why the scenario made sense. But I don't know. It was fine. Like, Ken, you have anything to add on Kareem?
I loved it. Another grotesque,
okay, go ahead.
Another grotesque case because it's like an inverted love story.
Mm-hmm.
And
again,
the same reason that Guillermo del Toro couldn't secure the funding for the movie, there has to be some happy love story. As a kid, that happy love story is what you've seen and everything. And then you see this thing, somebody's in love with and wants to, you know, do something for his beloved. And then he ends up becoming this undead thing because of it. It's just like very different than what I had seen. And I remember thinking learning as a kid about what was it, like how praying mantis after they mate, the woman kills the, I remember as a kid thinking, oh, this is like that game when I learned that.
Oh my God.
Right. You know,
like,
you know,
it was very creepy to me.
You know what I also thought of? This guy really went above and beyond for her, huh? Like
that's why I liked him. You know, I totally empathize.
It's like, and, do you want to defend this to the end of time? I mean, not fine. Like, I guess. I don't know.
Because I believe his love is revealed to have been killed by the time he reaches the artifact.
Yeah.
And that's the choice that's presented to him at the end. It's kind of in the grand scheme of things, maybe not as most plot significant a chapter as others, but I don't know. I think there were things to like about it. So next we have Maximilian Roivis, who is an ancestor of Edward and Alex in 1760 Rhode Island. He discovers a hidden city beneath the Roivis mansion and attempts to warn the world about it, but is locked in an asylum after murdering his servants, believing they were monsters. Greg, what do we think of this chapter?
So I think it's probably one of the better ones because it's very, very story specific. It takes place in the mansion where Alex is, so it's very obvious that it's important.
Yeah.
And I believe later in the game, you break into the room where he murdered all of his servants.
Yes,
I believe you do. So there's one part of this I didn't understand. Like, you can conduct autopsies on the monsters, but I don't think it does anything. Like, do you remember this?
Only briefly, and I don't remember if there's any effect, but
I do like how do I put this? He murdered all of his servants. The game kind of has this, because there's a sanity meter, he thinks he's seeing monsters. I'm not sure if they actually were, but in 1760, yeah, they'd put you in an asylum. Yeah. Like, you know, that seems about right.
Right.
I think what I had said earlier, I think is kind of what you're ringing true right now. The gameplay is like area and time period specific, and they found a way to take all these like time appropriate weapons and settings and make the gameplay symmetrical, which must have been difficult.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this one. Number one, because I do think as maybe as the game goes on, it's the short number of locations that you actually explore kind of hurts it. But at this point, I think it's really cool seeing the mansion in that era and how they really pay attention to how different everything looks. They make a point of like, there's an interactable like toilet, and it's like that, but he thinks it's like the bee's knees, like he's never seen anything like it before, and it's like all the furniture and everything is just completely different. I love that shit, but I really enjoy it. I mean, because adding to that about the reasoning behind him killing his servants and stuff is that there is a type of monster in the game that either is like living inside people or pretends to look like people, so that are in that chapter. So it's tough to say like whether he was genuinely insane or not, but I liked it. It was a good chapter. So Edwin Lindsay, who is a explorer in 1983 Cambodia, he is exploring the ruins of Angkor Thom where Elia was earlier, and he like talks to her zombie and gets the artifact from her for Edward. Do we remember this one?
Yeah. It's kind of strange how like he's traveling with Augustus, right? And then Augustus kind of reveals like, no, I'm here to kill you. Gotcha.
Well, that's right? Actually a good point where Augustus continually in these situations shows up in disguise.
Yeah.
And is kind of trying to manipulate events and stuff.
And I will say this, is he the first character in this order that survives his scenario? I think everyone else dies, right? At least leading up to this.
Or, well, Max gets imprisoned, but
right.
I believe so.
And like it's fine. Like I just didn't love that level in particular, like the it's like the Cambodian ruin, right?
Right.
It just wasn't my favorite, like with the traps, like Elia wasn't my favorite. With him, it's not my favorite. But it's interesting. In his scenario, I believe you discover the purple god, but it's optional. You don't actually have to do it.
Right.
So that's interesting. Like, Ken, do you have anything to add on him?
I just thought it was kind of forgettable. It felt sort of Indiana Jones.
That's literally what it is. Yeah.
I enjoyed like playing as him because he's got good stats and everything. He's got some cool weapons. It is a little bit of an Indiana Jones simulator, but ultimately fairly forgettable. I think that location in particular, not the strongest, but moving on to Paul Luther in 1485 France, a monk who is sent to the cathedral at Amiens to view a holy relic, but is detained there by the Inquisition. He winds up meeting Anthony from earlier, who is like a zombie now. You actually fight him. He puts him out of his misery and discovers, I think it's different depending on which artifact you chose, but there's a boss at this point that shows up. And I really loved this moment where it blows up his head. That really, really made the chapter for me. Greg, do you remember this one at all?
Sure. So I thought the most impactful moment of this was you discover Anthony, and then Anthony is still kind of speaking. You guys remember? He actually will like whisper Charlemagne as he's trying to walk around and zombie you.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Does the boss encounter change a little bit? Because like when I was playing as Paul and you get to the boss just turns you into jelly. He just stomps you and you just get completely flattened into like cranberry sauce.
The boss is something that you encounter later, but this is the first like appearance, I guess. And I think it may change depending on which one it is. Cause my guy's head exploded and I thought it was awesome. Okay. So contentious one here, Roberto Bianchi in 1460 Persia. He is a kidnapped Venetian surveyor who explores the Forbidden City from Pius's chapter. So Pius, who is disguised as a warlord, can build this like pillar of bodies in the desert. And at the end, he is thrown in and buried alive. Greg, what did you think of this guy?
It, honestly, it's not my favorite scenario. Like, playing as him is very annoying because I believe he has the slowest running speed and some of the slowest physical stats. Yes. And, like, what I didn't understand with this is, so Augustus wants you to build it. Well, he doesn't really want you to build it. He wants you to investigate the integrity of the tower because he wants to build it. But, like, why did Bianchi do this? Like, Augustus...
He was kidnapped, right?
That's true. But, like, you know, Augustus doesn't, you know, he doesn't come across as like overtly friendly or a guy you would want to work with, but Bianchi is he also like a rich architect from another country?
He's
right,
from
it's
Venice.
Like it's kind of bizarre.
He's from Venice, and it's like a weird kind of architectural survey, which doesn't necessarily seem to be something that a god would be concerned with. Like,
yeah,
I feel like if you want to build a thing, you go ahead and build it. But I don't know,
yeah,
maybe I missed something.
I don't know. It was fine. Like, Ken, do you have anything to add for this guy?
Yeah, the way you're describing it sounds sort of silly. Like, yeah, like demigod. And he needs someone to do like landscaping for him or whatever.
It's like, you know, I guess for all his godly powers, he still needs like landscapers and architects and like guys.
He doesn't have fingers.
So this is true.
Yeah. A little oversight on the part of the elder beings not to develop that opposable thumb.
It's I just thought it was funny how like you're not actually building it. He wants you to survey it for the integrity of it. It feels like a very like municipal project. Like,
again, being a national security reporter, this sounds like the procurement process where there's like 16,000 different things they need to go through, and apparently even the demigods of the universe have to contend with these bureaucracies.
It's like, yeah, dude, we got to put this up for bid. Like, if you could just, you know, give us an estimate.
I guess like. I can say this for a couple of the characters where I don't know of another game where you play as a surveyor, especially like during this era. And it's like, that's kind of unique. I feel like they're really just trying to get a lot of mileage out of these areas, and
yeah,
they were coming up with some interesting ideas, some less interesting ones. I don't know. I don't like playing as him, but it was kind of memorable. So I'm going to move on here to Peter Jacob in 1916 France. So he is a reporter during World War One who is stationed at the cathedral from the earlier French chapters. And this has been converted into a field hospital. He has a boss fight at the end. And when he's done with it, he gives one of the other artifacts to Edward Roivus. Greg, did you enjoy this chapter?
So I actually thought this is one of the scarier chapters, like where this game is a little bit more of a horror game.
Yeah.
Like, because you're in the church talking to people for a while, and like the nurses like slowly become monsters, right? And monsters really pile on you in some of these rooms.
Yeah.
I definitely disliked this boss battle. It drove me crazy. Like, I was running around this boss chamber for hours just trying to time the spell correctly, and it drove me nuts. Like, not to, I don't know, make a sanity meter joke, but like that, like I love this section and then quickly hated it. But it's one of the more story relevant chapters. I also want to bring this up. This game broke like a little bit of a rule for me where like, why was Paul immediately turned into jelly by the boss, but Peter can get beaten up and tossed around, but he's fine. Like, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Sure. Like, I don't, yeah. I enjoyed that. I know it's a little a little bit of an oxymoron, but I enjoy World War One as a setting, as horrible as it is. I find myself having an affinity for stories set during that time period and what a cultural global reckoning it was, saying a lot about humanity. And I think that in particular, like how, you know, I think the chapter is actually called "The War to End All Wars," which is what it was thought of at the time, and how, as you know, how it affected the sanity of humanity as a whole. And I think it was really cool to have a chapter set during that, and also to, you know, there are some better than others where they repurpose this earlier area in a very historically, what I would consider historically accurate way, by turning it into a field hospital for wounded soldiers. And you hear all like the, you know, the batteries in the background firing and anti-aircraft and that kind of thing. And it really, like, the vibe is completely different from when you're playing as like Anthony or the other guy. And I agree with you, Greg, that the boss was pretty frustrating. I don't really, because I think what happens is you wind up having to cast like dispel magic or magic attack, I think it is. And I wasn't sure like how close you have to stand, because it's really like, it's actually quite generous. And I was trying to get really close, and it has like some minions that can attack you and stuff. And it's, I mean, fighting a demigod can't be easy, but it was a little frustrating. So the next chapter is Alex's grandfather, Edward, in 1952 Rhode Island, who there is this invisible creature hunting down his servants, which you have to track down. And this kind of leads him to the hidden city that their ancestor Maximilian discovered. And there is this very strange part where you have to essentially cast a 9-part spell by going to these different like towers in a city, and this winds up wiping out Pius's army. And this is why he was targeted in the future by Pius for interfering in this way. Greg, what did you feel about this chapter?
So story-wise, it reveals why you're doing this in the first place, so it's very important. On hard mode, this broke my balls, dude. Like,
really?
Yep, because your health is lower, enemies kill you in 1 to 2 hits, and oh, shit. It was brutal, man. Like, I believe this character also has the lowest health maximum.
Really?
So, yeah, oh my god. Like, I hated this section a lot, but it does sort of reveal why he was murdered later, so it's plot vital, it's plot crucial.
Yeah.
And you also see the city underneath the mansion, and you explore it a lot, and and so obviously you can't cut it. But I hated playing it. Ken, did you have anything to add on the grandfather section?
Yeah, I liked it. I feel like executing that idea of Pius as this, guy controlling the marionette strings, it's like harder to pull off plausibly than you. I remember watching in college the Transformers movie, and they had, or maybe it was one of the million sequels, and they show the Transformers in the background when people are building the pyramids, and it's like they were kind of going for that same thing, but it just fell flat. It didn't work. When I was watching it, I was just like, that's fucking dumb. I just laughed when I watched it. And then thinking of this game, it's like, no, they executed it pretty well, I thought.
I'll also say, yeah, I'd say that's the soundbite of this episode.
I think so.
You guys remember that scene in the, maybe it was one of the sequels?
Is that in 2 or 3? I don't think it's the first one.
They were trying to do that Lovecraft, like humanity, you know,
through the centuries.
Yeah, exactly. And it fell flat. I mean, it's like this big shiny mech suit. It doesn't work. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think I saw that one. The last thing I remember seeing was Shia LaBeouf, spoiler, gets killed and gets sent to robot heaven. So that's where I tapped out.
Yeah.
It was a little too much for me.
I only remember him shouting Optimus really loud.
Put the cube in my chest.
Yeah. I don't know. This chapter is, I like the design of the city quite a lot. I think it looks really cool. But it crops up again later. It's a little repetitive when you have to go to these different like towers and like put a symbol. And if you screw it up, you have to do it over again, or at least the ones that you got wrong. But overall, I mean, it was cool to see the reveal. So the next one is Michael Edwards, who is in 1991 Iraq, formerly Persia, Canadian firefighter who is putting out oil fires after the Gulf War. An explosion at one of these leaves him trapped in the Forbidden City from the prior chapters, which he winds up destroying using magically enchanted C4, which I thought was awesome. And later on, he meets up with Edward, and I think he gives him the last artifact. Greg, what did you think of this one?
Yeah, so I thought this was a good example of how tasteful they did all the periods of time. This guy, I remember laughing a little bit when I saw it said Desert Storm. I'm like, what the fuck? We're going to Desert Storm?
Yeah, like,
okay.
It's crazy.
Do you know what? I will say this. This Desert Storm chapter was much more enjoyable than the GameCube game Conflict Desert Storm, which was a really bad shooter. So I'll say this. Like, at this point, I'm not saying I was tired of the game as a whole, but I was a little bit tired of the gameplay loop. I'm like, okay, we're doing this again. And now I'm a guy with a bunch of assault weapons and we're blowing. I don't know. Like, it's fine. I think this chapter is really just this is the setup so Alex can get the Enchanted Gladius and can get the last artifact. It feels almost like a way to a way to get us to like 10 years closer to the plot, even though
just filling that plot hole from earlier. Like,
yeah, I don't know. I think at this point I was tired of shooting red zombies with M4s and like M16s. Like, I don't really understand this, but it's fine. Ken, do you recall this one at all? It's fine.
Yeah, I liked it because it was shortly, if I remember right, the game was a little after 9/11.
Yes.
And this is like my earliest political recollections because it was just like total jingoism. Do you remember all the gold ribbons and everything?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Everything was so flat and two dimensional. And it was like, there's the good guys and the bad guys and everything. And then watching this, and again, seeing that get perverted and turned into this grotesque thing that was very different than what you were seeing, because there was total dominion by the news networks at the time. And so there was like one narrative being pushed at you. And then watching this, not that it was like necessarily subverting that in any sort of political way, but just like, I don't know, seeing. And then I remember asking my friend, I was like, what was Desert Storm? It's like, oh, that was, we were there before. And it's reopening this history at that. Maybe, yeah. I mean, I don't know how, again, maybe this is just through the lens of a kid learning about everything at the same time that it was happening. But I remember something about it.
You know what it is? I think, cause I think all of us are in a similar age. I think what this, it may have been more effective for our age group. Cause I'm like, oh wait, Desert Storm. This game came out in 2002. It's a more recent political event that I know something about.
Right.
Right. Where like, I don't know anything. I shouldn't say anything, but my knowledge of medieval Persia is limited. Right.
Sure.
So like, yeah. But my knowledge of Desert Storm, it's something I could more easily Wikipedia and like understand what that conflict was.
A few people who were involved are maybe still kicking around, you know.
Right, right. Like, how much do you know about medieval Cambodia? Like, me is like not much, like not a lot,
not a whole lot.
Yep.
I think for my part, I really enjoyed this one. You know, as you said, Greg, maybe the formula was perhaps wearing a little thin, but I thought it was great. Not only because I think, you know, when you have this guy who is running around with all this modern weaponry and stuff, it does feel like kind of a culmination of all these different characters who, you know, you start out with all you can really do is swing a sword. And then, you know, this is where humanity is at this point. Like you said, it's the most recent, and it's kind of, it is a good kind of contrast with other games at the time, especially, you know, the next, I would say 6 to 7 years was all, you know, kind of Iraq adjacent, like shooters dominating the market and stuff, you know, modern warfare and all that stuff.
But it was so triumphalist. And this game is all about the humanity is losing. And that was such an interesting counterpoint at the time, because nobody, it's just completely contrary to your expectations, you know?
There are a ton of games where you're, you know, kind of a like a leatherneck getting dropped into Iraq or Afghanistan or something. But this is literally, I can't think of any other game that would even do this in the future, where you have this Canadian firefighter putting out oil fires in after the Gulf War, which is I was completely ignorant of before I played this game, because I know a little bit about the Gulf War, but not really, you know, the cleanup or anything like that and the aftermath. And this game does kind of have that like Carmen Sandiego effect, where I learn a little bit more about each era without, you know, like, you know, oh, that's, you know, something to put in my brain here. But I enjoyed it for the most part. Greg, did you want to say something else about that?
I was just going to say, like, we're coming up on the end of the story. There's only one more, right?
Right.
Let's go into the last little bit.
Yeah. This is where you take control of Alex fully at the end. Alex Rivas in 2000, Rhode Island. So she wraps up her little investigation here, travels to the ancient city beneath the mansion, and summons the god that can defeat the one that you're facing against. And you do this doing the same thing that Edward did with the towers and putting in the symbols and stuff. And following this, she has a final boss fight against Pius, where she is aided by the ghosts of some of the other characters. And so once one god defeats the other, Edward kind of steps in and vanquishes the other gods so that humanity can live on. Greg, what did you think about this?
I mean this in the nicest way to this game. I think I was all set with the gameplay loop at this point. The final puzzle takes forever. And I think this is probably one of the more gamey parts of the game, where you have to fight this boss. If you have the Enchanted Gladius, you just swing at him. right? You keep your buff spells on. This is like, I feel like this is like the gamer's gamer moment of this game. Sure. Where like, I'm going to get my buffs going, I'm taking out my best stuff. Let's do this. Yeah. Like, it was kind of cute how you had to play as the ghosts of other characters and take swings at them. You get a little reminder of who came before you, kind of like, hey, this has been going on for thousands of years. Before I kick it to Ken, I do want to say that I don't know how I feel about this, where I feel like I'm torn between, I feel like the puzzles in the mansion leading up to this moment are kind of spoon fed to you. Like you can go into the observatory room so many times and do nothing with it. But I feel like in so many moments in the mansion, the next thing you do is almost told to you. Like, hey, you have the spell, go do the thing. It's actually more linear than I would have liked. And there isn't a lot of I feel like the puzzle solving as Alex is a little bit, how do I put this? It comes across as more obtuse than it actually is. And then right. When you get down into the final part, I'm kind of all set with the gameplay. Like, I kind of just want to see how this plot resolves and be done personally. Sure.
Okay.
So I mean, Ken, do you have any thoughts about this final scenario? Final, or I guess anything about the mansion, I guess, puzzle solving, Alex's environment?
If I'm remembering the ending correctly, something that was particularly intriguing to me was this idea that humanity's only shot is when the demigods are fighting with each other.
Yeah.
And again, much later, reading Greek mythology, you realize, oh, that's like a well-established thing in human literature.
Yeah.
But it's, again, happening against the backdrop of this post 9/11 very black and white moral drama of like the good guys versus the bad guys. And then you see this much more cynical picture of how things work that I think comports more with political reality, that there are factions, powerful factions fighting with each other. And in those moments, that's when the mere mortals can tip the scales. Something about that really stuck with me. I don't know why.
I think Chaturga is going to defeat Zolotov in the next primary for sure.
nice.
I think that's the way it's going to play out. I share some of Greg's grievances about the gameplay, but I think it really kind of tied it all together when you have those other like ghost characters showing up and kind of feeling like the crest of a mountain, like of all this stuff kind of culminating in this 2000 year journey really, really finally paying off here. And I thought it was really interesting as well about how the bosses, the gods rather, they kill each other in different ways, where I think the Chaturga, the red one, is the strong one. So he just like rips the other one apart. And then the magic guy, the blue one, makes the other god kill itself or something. And it's
I don't know.
It's like there's different ways that it plays out, and it all feels very kind of in line with the general Lovecraftian ethos, where you have these different kind of levels of insanity, and the way they're going to kind of play off each other, the way they each interact with Pius is different as well depending on their personality. So I think that's pretty cool, like whether or not he takes an active role in influencing events. I don't know, it's like it ends pretty much as you'd expect, but it did have a feeling of satisfaction at the end. Getting into kind of into the ending here, point of note I wanted to mention that I didn't realize is that Roivis is savior spelled backwards. So they did a little tricky there. I appreciate that. Do you guys have any other thoughts on the story, as well as maybe do you know anything about the secret ending once you do all three of them?
All I know is if you do the three paths, something happens, but I only did one. Like I didn't like, Ken, do you know anything about like doing all of them and how it changes?
I only know it's just so interesting because it's the first game where I couldn't beat it on the harder modes. So I didn't know, but I was curious to find out. And I went online to find out. A lot of games, it's kind of like an afterthought, right?
Right.
You don't really care what happens. It's just filler to get you between action scenes or whatever.
Yeah.
So I remember looking it up and being really interested in how the storyline was described, which I think was that you basically end up destroying most of them, and then there's only one left and it's like injured or something like that.
I think you're right. Like the purple one who dominates all survives, but or something like that. But you have to do essentially they're trying to do like the three timelines thing, right? Where the three go. I don't know. It's some. I don't know, Riley. What do you got? You know, we're getting out of my realm of interest here with these timeline plots. Go ahead.
No, I think supposedly so. All three of them are supposedly happening at the same time, just in different realities. And this has been. The entire plot of Eternal Darkness has been the machination of the purple god because, you know, just to get rid of the competition or whatever and have kind of reign supreme. But it is it's like incapable of acting itself. I think you said it's injured or weak or something like that. And so it's been putting all this into motion itself, which I think is kind of interesting.
Also very evocative of Lovecraft. If I remember right, one of like 90% of his stories ended, you know, humanity's fucked. And then I think there was maybe one or two that were like ambiguous like this, where it's like they win the battle temporarily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You've staved this off for now.
Yeah. Kind of wrapping up here. I think it's fair to say we all consider Eternal Darkness to be a very unique game.
I hated it.
We all hated it. Don't play it. Don't even listen to this episode. But beyond what we've already said, anything else you'd like to mention about how special this game feels, especially compared to, you know, say the releases of today?
So do you want me to start? Yeah, I'll start. We're doing final thoughts here. Yes, Riley?
Yeah.
Okay. So final thoughts. I think what was interesting is I think it's always tough when you play a game for the first time, but it was from 20 years ago, right? Where I played Eternal Darkness for the first time a month ago. You know, I'm 31. I didn't play it when I was, you know, 12 or 13.
Sure.
So I think what's interesting to me is because I've played so many games that it took aspects from, I'm able to analyze it a little bit differently. Where the Resident Evil 1 remake, I've said this, you know, on the show so many times, like is one of my favorite games ever. And seeing how Eternal Darkness took the shooting and inventory, but also put a magic system into it. And it's also kind of like Myst. And there's an insanity meter. And it's time relevant. And everything is time and period appropriate. There's a, as Ken said a couple of times, there's a lot happening. Not all of it is the best execution, but it comes together to be better than the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
Like, it's not the best Resident Evil game. It's not the best action RPG. It's not the best Myst game. But it's also so bonkers and unique that you can't help but appreciate when it came out and what it did as a whole.
Yeah.
So I think, as if I'm remembering correctly, this game is very universally acclaimed. It has a high Metacritic score, but it didn't sell many units. Like this was a commercially successful game.
Right.
And also, this is the last good game that Silicon Knights put out. And then a couple of years later, Epic Games sued them and killed them. And now they're no longer a company. So, Ken, I'll leave you with that. Like your like final thoughts, like overall about Eternal Darkness. Anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I think it's clear at this point that I, you know, really admired it, and it was one of the first things for me that made me realize, like what I was saying about genre fiction before, that the distinction between art and entertainment, in some cases, can break down if the, you know, creators are ambitious enough, and it's also a source of great frustration to me. And makes it hard for me not to have the grumpy lefty in me come out that they raise money on this thing that is like universally beloved. I've never heard a bad thing about it from any of the GameCube fans that I know. How could they not do it? And really, kind of like the point of the game, it only really was allowed to be financed because of this rare situation in which the demigods were fighting, being Nintendo and the other companies.
Yeah.
For market share.
Wow, that's
and momentarily saying, okay, we need an older people audience game.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a moneymaker, but just enough to say that we're gonna be making games for older people. Here's one rare opportunity you can have to kind of like just explore the palette and do what you want to do as artists, you know.
Wait a minute. What you said was so funny. I need to expand on it a little bit because there are four gods in this game, right? Think about it. At that time, there was Nintendo, Sony, Microsoft, and Sega.
That's what I'm saying.
Was still a company.
I wasn't being cute when I was saying that. I think this comports with reality in a certain sense, right?
Yeah.
Like, in the kind of naive market view, it's like, oh, there's going to be a market for this game. It's like, no, they're going to be competing for market share before someone's established a monopoly, and then they don't care what anybody wants at that point. And so in this moment,
the mortals can accomplish something great, but only in that moment.
Yeah, you know? while they're all busy fighting each other out of self-interest, you know, we can accomplish wonders.
Jesus, what but, a good bow on that. Riley, what do you got, dude, to top that?
Not a whole lot. Maybe if you guys could give this a grade, what do you think?
Okay, so Ken, quick breakdown. So grading system, we do letter grades like school. So here we go. I feel like my heart wants to say A minus, but I feel I lean towards B plus because of how repetitive the gameplay is, but the game is so tasteful. It's hard for me to put it in that range. I think the Metacritic on this game is like a 90, which is like an A minus. I feel like I'm right there. Like maybe, you know what I'm going to do? Maybe you guys can sway me. Where okay. I feel like I want to say B plus, but I want to hear what Ken has to say and then what Riley has to say, and maybe I'll change. But Ken, could you go grade school on this? Go ahead.
Well, I'm a little uncomfortable because I was grade school when I played it. And so I don't know, like how you were saying that, you know, that in any art, the different artists are in dialogue with each other. You can't look at one thing in isolation. You have to understand what is the context in which it's appearing? Who are they responding to? What are they borrowing from? I don't have a great sense of how much originality there was there. As a kid, it seemed extremely original, but maybe that's just because I didn't play many other, you know, horror type games or anything. But as far as I can tell, I would give it an A, but I'm definitely not a curator.
Riley, what have you got? I wonder if you'll sway me. I did not look at your grade beforehand. So what do you got?
I'm done putting those in my notes. I'm hiding them from you just so I don't influence you at all. No, on top of everything we've already said, I think it's so unique. You would never see Nintendo greenlight a game like this for the Switch or anything like that. It's like you would at most see like a really high effort AA indie production that could do something like this. You know, it's just like dealing with the concepts that it's addressing and all these different systems that are, you know, maybe some a little too obtuse, but overall everything working together, you have this incredibly ambitious story over 2,000 years and how somehow the gameplay between all these different people is the same universal experience at its core, I think is a very powerful message just in terms of overcoming, you know, the forces of eternal darkness, as it were. And I think I'm going A minus on this one. What do you think?
Sure. I think I am going to stay at B plus, but I'll give it the highest B plus possible, which is 89. Right. So right. I think we have all three A minus and B plus. So Riley, do you want to take us to the end here? I think you've got what, one or two more, then we're going to wrap.
Yeah, I just out of curiosity, could you guys, or would you even want a sequel, or could you see it coming to fruition?
What do
you
think? I absolutely would want one, and I can't see one because of the market dynamics that we described before. Yeah. I just feel like this kind of ambition is not rewarded. The Gestalt that I was talking about before, the stuff that's rewarded, look at the games. Photorealistic Call of Duty type shooters, which are amazing. This is exactly why I grade on a curve for a game like this, because the Gestalt is never rewarded. What's rewarded is being an expert at one of these things instead of trying all 12 of them at the same time. You know what I mean? And mastering one thing and making it perfect and really responsive and everything. So it's like, I want to go out of my way to give credit to people that try that incur the, you know, frankly, probably career risk not to do that. Cause it's probably a pretty safe way to go. Just like mastering one. It's like playing Smash Brothers. You could get really good at one character. I always respect the people that know that are ambidextrous. They can play a bunch of different characters. And that's what I saw in this game.
So we're not going to get a sequel because Silicon Knights got sued into being killed. They're bankrupt. They're toast.
But also I did want to mention, kind of playing into what Ken said, that there was a Kickstarter that failed. They just did not get enough funding, unfortunately. So there's some like footage of it. There was going to be kind of a similar thing with different people in different times. But, you know, obviously the fidelity has increased significantly since then. I think this was like 2016, something like that. But it's a shame because I think like even a remake could definitely like help, you know, the awareness of this game. I think it would help the gameplay hold up a little bit better. It's a shame that it will remain kind of this this piece of apocrypha, if you will.
But, yeah, but we'll get another Transformers sequel. We'll have more Marvel movies to look for. That's exactly why I want to give a game like this credit. Because look at what they do instead. It's just total risk aversion on everything.
Yeah,
it culture sucks because of it. I don't even play games anymore.
Yeah,
it's all the same shit every time. Yeah. You know, it's like number 14, or it's ridiculous. I don't even particularly dislike Call of Duty. I play Call of Duty with my friends, but it's kind of like, can we have something different?
You know? Ken, fine, A-. Okay, are you happy?
That's. I think the last couple of years have changed me in that way, where stuff that used to bother me, I respect the big swings more than I used to creatively. Yeah.
Ken, we're going to end with you. Well, so there's two last questions. So is there anything like, or where people can find you, or something you're working on, you want to bring attention to people, that sort of thing? Anything you want to say?
Check out my Substack. I'll be posting more on there about subjects like this, like cultural stuff. You know, all my reporting goes on The Intercept. It's just kenklippenstein.substack.com. And I spend a lot of my time on Twitter. Say hello to me on there.
That's awesome. We'll repost any links in our descriptions and stuff like that.
I appreciate it.
So the last thing is, it's a tradition on this show that the guest of the show intros goddamn GameCube. And Ken, you've got the script. If you could intro the show for us when you're ready.
Hey everyone, this is Ken Klippenstein, reporter for The Intercept, and you're listening to Goddamn GameCube.
Hell yeah. Thank you very much. So, Riley, I'm wrapped on this. Are you done? You toast on this one?
I got everything.
Cool. Right on. Anyway, thank you, Ken, so much for being here. And this has been Goddamn GameCube, and we will see you all next time. Thank you very much.